Welcome to another episode of Let's Talk Small Data with T, where we are passionate about the power of small data in healthcare. I am your host, Tanasia Gonzalez, but you can call me T. Data has certainly changed the game in healthcare. Big data has blown the roof off, but small data, now that's the future. Small data allows us to dive deep into the key insights and take quick, customized action to achieve phenomenal results in performance and quality improvement. Let's explore this today. Thanks so much for joining us. If you have any questions for me or any of my guests, feel free to reach out to me at tgonzalez@eima-inc.com. Enjoy the show. Let's go. Welcome, welcome, everyone. Good evening. This is the very first episode of Let's Talk Small Data with T. That's me. I'm so happy to be here. I'm happy that you are here joining in this journey with us. Tonight, we're going to be talking about the power of small data in healthcare. And I will be introducing my panelists tonight who are just as excited about small data as I am. I'm so excited to bring them on and start the discussion. But before I do that, I want to send a big thank you to Mark Benkova of ELC Studios for the incredible intro video that you just saw. I also want to send out a huge thank you to Daniela Gillette of 5-Star BDM. She's been an integral part of the podcast development and helping me, working hand in hand with me to make sure we're set up for success. So thank you to both of you. And to the attendees, thanks so much for joining us tonight. I just want to let you know that there is a poll in there and you can access it, access the poll by clicking on the poll button at the bottom of the screen. Sometime towards the end of the webinar, just to give us a little feedback about what we did well and what we can do to improve for next time. So without further delay, I would like to introduce, I'd like to introduce my panelists. Panelists, I'd like you to go ahead and show your cameras. You should be able to do that right now. Hello, hello, hello. Hi, guys. Okay, let me just make sure I have the right view on. Hello, I see all of your beautiful faces. So let me go ahead and introduce. I will start with Peter Jackson. Just raise your hand there so everyone knows who I'm talking about. There you are. Peter Jackson is joining us from London. He is the Chief Data and Analytics Officer of Carruthers and Jackson, and he's a co-author of three books on data, The Data-Driven Business Transformation, and also The Chief Data Officer's Playbook, and the recently published second edition of The Chief Data Officer's Playbook. Peter, welcome to the show. Dr. Robin Kerner, who is based in New York City, she's a clinical psychologist, and she's currently serving as a senior project director at Columbia University. And Robin is one of the country's foremost experts on seasonal affective disorder, or SAD. And we're seeing a lot of that, right, given the current pandemic. Robin has also made a couple of TV appearances, gifting live audiences with her expertise on behavioral health issues. So Robin, welcome to the show.
Thanks for having me.
Thank you. Next up, we have Yosef Miller. He's joining us from Long Island, which is my home. And he's currently serving as the Director of Analytics for Operations at ProHealth. Yosef has a vast analytics portfolio and over 15 years experience in the healthcare data space. And I like to call him the optimizer. We've actually worked together in the past, and I got to see his mastery in person. Yosef, welcome to the show. Last but certainly not least is Zoe Papazoglou. Said that right, right? She's also joining us from New York, Long Island, New York. She's currently the clinical director and co-founder of Dragonfly ABA, or Applied Behavior Analysis, serving an autistic population and their families. Zoe is a board-certified behavior analyst and special educator. She has over 13 years of experience in the field of ABA. Zoe, thank you for your participation and welcome to the show. Okay, so if you guys, if the panelists can please unmute your cameras, unmute yourselves. Awesome. Let's get into the agenda. Okay, so we're going to talk about this thing called small data tonight. We're also going to mention this thing called big data. And the first question I'm going to shoot to Peter. We hear big data, small data all the time. We've got a whole podcast about this thing called small data. What exactly is big data and small data? Can you just get everybody on a level playing field?
Well, good evening. That's an excellent question to start off with. And I think the best way to define what small data is to start with that awful phrase, big data. What is big data? Mm-hmm. Big data are data sets which are too large or too complex to be dealt with by traditional processes. Trouble with big data is there's some inherent problems. There's so much noise quite often at the big data that you struggle to find the signal. You struggle to find the insight. Also, big data tends to draw data from lots of different sources that can be very siloed and hard to bring together. Its accuracy can be lost in the volume of the data. You don't know what is accurate, what's not accurate. It's hard to verify. It's hard to set up duplicates. It's hard to update big data sets. So there are fundamental problems with it. Also, you tend to need particular skills to engineer big data and to drive the insights out of big data. So that, beyond the data itself, it makes it very inaccessible for the subject matter expert to get at the insights of the data. Whereas small data, by comparison, is small enough for human processing and human comprehension. It's far more accessible in that sense. Its volume and its format are accessible, it's informative, and it's more importantly, actionable. And I'm sure all of those things to the panelists here are things that resonate. You know, the accessibility, it's informative, and it's accessible. So big data is all about machines. And for me, in this context in healthcare, it's about populations. Whereas small data is very much more about people and individuals. Right. And therefore, big data, I think as we talked about on Friday last week, was it's to do with trends and patterns. Whereas small data is to do with the anomalies and the exceptions. And particular uses of small data, I was thinking about this afternoon, I could just think of loads and loads of uses outside of healthcare that I've come across. I was in utilities, and we think about the sensors in the field, you know, IoT, Internet of Things, the sheer volume of data we got back from our water network. 99% of it, we weren't interested in. It was just telling us that everything was fine. Is that 1% we wanted to know about? The small data. Really, really important to us, because that is where something was going wrong. And at that point, you could almost slip into what I would prefer to call artificial intelligence. You can slip into augmented intelligence. In other words, is this all data that's helping us, helping the humans, helping the subject matter experts make their decisions? So small data is superb for risk management. You can cut the noise out. And you can find those anomalies. It's brilliant for risk management. It's also, in retail, it's so good for hyper-personalization. And I'm sure that that will have an impact in healthcare as well. So I hope I've given some sort of flavor or difference to start us off between big data, patterns, trends, hard to get at, specialist skills, small data, accessible, actionable, really ready insights.
Yes, no, totally. And you actually jumped into my second question. I think your answer will be yes. So I've heard that you are a believer that small data is the future. You know, everyone's so focused on this big data thing, but the small data, as you said, helps us dive in and find those particular anomalies and really take action and move some stuff. Any other thoughts?
You're right. My answer is yes. Yeah. I think that it's important we're having these conversations to shift that dial back again. Now, I started off when you asked me the first question, you know, I hate the phrase big data. It has been overused, way overused. And we've all sort of focused over there on big data. And the other one's artificial intelligence. What is artificial intelligence?
Right.
We've all concentrated on this, and we've actually forgotten the things on a day-to-day basis are really actionable and are really important.
Right.
I remember if I go back to early 80s when I was at university and I was doing statistics, you know, you do a linear regression, you could see the line. What was really interesting was the bits that didn't fit the line. It's those exceptions, those anomalies. So I think small data does need to become more important.
Okay, beautiful. Thank you. Would anyone else from the panel like to chime in on that, say a few words on that? Or let's just move on. Let's keep it going. we're talking about, you know, the small data. It sounds really interesting. And, you know, I'm a small data lover, obviously, and this whole podcast to bring folks on to talk about it. I'm going to pitch the next question to Robin, because the population you serve, I have a specific interest in. And I would really love to find ways to serve providers serving this population, particularly with small data. And with this population you serve, have you seen the power of small data? Do you feel there's a need, just coming from your experience?
So a resounding yes to that question. Exactly. So thank you for teeing that up. So just to level set, the population that I'm serving right now with the project that I'm working on with Columbia University is called the Healing Community Study. And we're working across four states to try to fight the opioid epidemic. And so your question really resonates, T, because we are using big data, obviously. We're looking at claims. We're looking at this population, and we're looking at population health with regards to opioid use disorder, but we're really interested in the health of a very specific population with a small p, and as Peter, you were saying, that the people that are impacted by this disease. And as you just said, T, we also are looking to change provider behavior. So, you know, a story I can tell is, you know, we get a lot of big data about the number of providers and prescribers of medications for opioid use disorder. Again, in case people aren't aware, you need to have right now a special waiver to prescribe this medication. So we can get lots of reports as to how many people in each county are trained, how many providers can prescribe this medication. But then we need to look at who is actually doing the prescribing, because when you dig into it and you start looking at the small data, you can look at the provider level, each prescriber, and you can see that they're licensed to prescribe up to, you know, 75 or 300 patients on their panel. And yet when you dig under it, they might not have any patients, even though they're able to prescribe. So by looking at the small data at that prescriber level, you can have conversations about, you know, what's going on? What are the barriers? You know, what might facilitate somebody getting on board and prescribing more medication, taking more patients onto their panel? And you can also aggregate that small data into maybe medium data at the organization level. And you can learn a lot at the level of people and organizations about what we can do better to service these individuals.
Right. And then once you dive in to that level of detail, you could like set up some kind of tracker to try and see like
exactly
the changes that you've made. Are they making a, you know, a difference? And if not, you know, typical quality improvement like we used to do all
right
the time, right? So
exactly. Yeah. And people can get very intimidated by the idea of big data, even the term data. They assume it means big data. And the story I like to tell is some data is just captured on paper and pencil, hashtags. I mean, I love computer systems. I love Excel spreadsheets. I love fancy forms. But some of the best data is just collected by somebody when they walk in the door and they put a hashtag on a form and they're just counting. Very old fashioned, but old fashioned can work when it comes to small data. And I think sometimes we forget that.
Right. Especially if that is where the provider is and his or her mindset, right?
Like yes.
If you're like, you can collect your data in a number of different ways. It doesn't have to be a big fancy computer system. You don't have to be a statistician. You don't have to do a quadratic equation every time someone comes in. You know, you could, you know, just do it in the way that you feel comfortable and that works for you. So, yeah, I mean, that's a nice segue into the next question. So in terms of like, how do we construct things to house small data and how do we work with it? Yossi, so this question I'm going to pitch to you. I know that you've created a number of different tools, and I've seen you at work. And let me ask you something. What advantages did Access to Small Data offer you in the tools that you were creating? And could these same tools have been created using big data tools?
So let me echo something that Peter and Robin and Tia, you've said already. Kind of go through the progression of an organization from their inception, at least in terms of data, through their small data capabilities. So let's say you have an organization that's brand new, and they know they need more sales. So the mission statement is we need more sales. They don't give any more information than that. It's just we need more sales. And everyone agrees there's nothing wrong about that. Now you introduce some data aspects to this organization. They have some capabilities. They have people who could look at some numbers. So they say, okay, great. Now we need 500 sales this month, 500 items to be sold. Keep going along. They get a little more advanced. They have some big data. They have old claims going on, what's happened the last couple of years in the industry. And now they know that, well, last year we had 400. This year we need to have 500. This month we need to have 500. Mm-hmm. That's where big data kind of stops. We know what we had. We know what we need to have. Here's the trend. Here's what's going on. This is what needs to get done. But the question is then, well, what needs to get done? What do we actually do with that to improve on the organization, to get it from that 400 to the 500? And that's where small data comes in. We mentioned this the other week that we have, I have the three A's of small data, which are access, action, and accountability. Access, that the individuals, as Peter mentioned, not just the SMEs who know what they're doing on the computer, coding, to be able to access the information. Everyone can access the information. Action, provide the what you're going to actually do with this data, use this information to your advantage, and most importantly, perhaps, accountability. Who is actually going to do this? Who is going to take the lead? Who is going to be responsible? And following with my example, instead of saying, you know, we had 400, now we need to have 500, we could go in and understand that, well, if you look at medical supplies last year, the last 2 years, we've actually been declining. Why have we been declining? Well, maybe we need to work with the liaison to that department. Maybe we need to come up with a plan, quality improvement, a process there, where we can actually identify that we have, say we had 65, we need to get to 85, and we're going to do it with, Peter's going to take this part of the equation, Robin's going to take this part, and Zoe's going to finish that part. And together, we're going to report out to the executives each week. At this point, we actually have a way of holding everyone accountable for the work that we're doing. No longer do we say, here's the data, we're going to get better. It's now, here's how we're going to get better. So I think that big data can, to answer your second question first, I think big data can do a lot for us. I think that kind of stops before it makes it really powerful what we can do in an organization. So you mentioned some of the tools that we've worked on in the past or that I've built. So the first one I want to share is one that didn't actually work. And the reason I'm going to share this one first is because one of the things that I've noticed within the data world, it takes a lot of effort, a lot of staff to put some of these big data elements together. They're not super flexible. They often take a while for the business to impart their knowledge onto the people who are building these. When it comes to small data, when you're dealing with smaller subsets of data, when you're dealing with people who are maybe closely related to the operations of what's going on, you can trial and error. You can fail a few times. You can put things together and it not work out, and it didn't waste that much time. It didn't cost that much effort. Whereas if you're going to run a whole big project, you need to make sure every single thing is perfect before you could even embark in it. And how often do we spend weeks or months working on something for it to just not pan out? So my first tool that I put together, that I know, T, I know you appreciated this one, was what we called the PET project, which is the Provider Engagement Tool, PET. It's very difficult in a large organization to track and follow how well people are engaged. Often your numbers, whatever you're trying to get at, will grow based on how strongly people are engaged in your business, how much people agree with what you're trying to preach, with what you're trying to improve on. How do you actually engage their engagement? How do you tell how engaged a provider is, or a location is, or pharmacy is? There's many qualitative aspects that you can identify, but not many quantitative. So we kind of, well, what I did with this tool was I kind of explored some smaller quantitative aspects to see if we could build a tool to identify who is engaged and are they actually engaged currently. And the reason I'm saying that is because if you just think about your own businesses, I'm sure there's many times where you believe you know who's engaged. These 15 people are really engaged. These 30 people are not engaged. At the end of the day, the ones who are engaged, are they actually engaged constantly? Or you just have a preconceived notion that once they did something great for you, now they're constantly engaged. Whereas maybe that's not the case. Maybe they're not actually improving on your business currently. Just remember them that they're doing a good job.
This episode is brought to you by Effective Information Management Assistance, specializing in healthcare small data and offering expertise that goes beyond technology. Visit www.eima-inc.com to learn more about Emma and the podcast, Let's Talk Small Data with T.
So we looked at certain things like attendance in certain meetings. We looked at to be able to quantify things, responses to emails. At the end of the day, it's very qualitative. It's very difficult to identify.
Yeah, I'm sorry to interrupt you. I was just going to say what I like about what you're saying is that, you know, we had to tease out what were their specific metrics. So that's a very important thing that you can do, you know, as you're gathering the data so that you could track, you know, the success of your project, whatever you're doing, whatever you built to use. So I like how, you know, like you said, it wasn't very apparent what quantitative analysis we could gather, but from the qualitative analysis, we kind of made it quantitative, saying, you know, we're going to assign a value to this. We're going to assign a value to that and just decide on, okay, moving forward, this is how we will measure. So that's, I love it. I mean, you're incredibly creative and, you know, came up with a lot of great tools. And, you know, me, my go-to is Access, and a lot of IT folks go, oh my God, Access. But with simple Microsoft Access, we've been able to, Peter's laughing, he's probably one of them. I've been able to create some real change, like positive change in organizations that didn't have anything else available. And using that one tool, a little imagination and creativity, and knowing where you're trying to be, like knowing your destination, building something that's very customized and specific to get you there. Access has come to the party, come to the savior, so to speak. So thank you. Yeah.
You know that I live in Excel.
Yes.
And I think that I learned plenty from Access in the past. And I think that one of the points that you just mentioned is that customizability, that it's not going to be nothing's going to be cookie cutter. Nothing's going to be exact. If you try to build anything, there's going to be plenty of exceptions. And these smaller tools, which are, no pun intended, more accessible to the people who are working in this, in the organizations, are very important to be able to move things along.
Right. Thank you. Yeah, they're not so intimidating and, you know, you could just make it easy peasy. So Zoe.
Hi.
Hi. So I'd like to ask you, you know, in your world, you have a very beautiful program there at Dragonfly ABA dealing with your population. Are there any stories of the power of small data that you can think of? Any examples? Can you tell us a story of where you saw the power of small data?
Absolutely. So with what we do, everything is small data. In the world of ABA, applied behavior analysis, we are actually taking in the moment data on every single child for every single goal throughout their entire session, and then graphing it at the end of every session. So that way we can see, is there a decrease in maladaptive behaviors? Is there an increase in their goal objective, whatever it might be? And then we're able to objectively see, is progress being made and where are we at? So for example, let's say that we're doing an FBA, which is a functional behavior assessment. we can take data and we can say, okay, in this environment, we're seeing some self-injurious behavior. But when we take out, you know, the background noise or a certain sensory object or maybe another person that's in the room, we see that the behavior decreases. So we're able to say, okay, you know, like we might know what the antecedent is to a certain behavior and fix it from there or adjust from there. Or if we're doing skill acquisition, for instance, if we're teaching a child how to wash their hands, we'll break that into really small increments. It might be turning on the water, putting 3 pumps of soap on your hand, you know, scrubbing for 30 seconds, whatever it might be. But we're actually taking data as to the prompt level. So do they need a full physical prompt hand over hand to scrub their hands, or are they able to do that independently? And from, so we're breaking everything down and just graphing everything. We're taking data on every single step. So that way we could see that progress is being made, because how easy is it to say, oh, look, my kid's washing their hands, but are they, have they made progress, you know, or it could be something, you know, increasing social skills. Are they actually increasing on their social skills? Are they actually maybe leading a conversation or taking turns or sharing? Or is it just that they happen to be more comfortable with that person and they're not generalizing a certain skill set? Same with reading. And you can apply it to almost everything. So each child has a completely unique program based on their assessment. And from there, we develop the goals and we take the data on the goals. It was really interesting before. Robin had talked about, you know, paper and pencil data and as opposed to electronic. And that's the big thing in ABA right now. It's, you know, and I remember this, used to get a thick binder and it was filled with just data sheets, you know, and we were taking data on everything, you know, 25 different goals that a child might have in their program throughout the hours. And then I would have to go back and take this stack of data and enter it into Excel. And now, you know, programs like CenterReach is taking a lot of that out of there. But at the same time, then we have an iPad, you know, and we're taking data on the iPad. But what's being lost in the transition from paper to electronic, and which one's better? And, you know, there's so many different options. It's really fun to play around with the different graphs, and I get very geeky with it. And I love seeing, like, okay, the different phase lines and the changes. But so that's kind of what I can understand that
well. So as you were describing that, that's not small data. That's minute. Minute data.
Yes, it is. It's on a very individual
level. Love it. Yeah, totally. So, you know, I'm going to pass this one out. Thank you, everyone. I'm going to shoot a question out for the panel. Do you feel the industry, healthcare, I'm talking about, is moving towards leaning more on small data? Why or why not? Anyone can give that one a try or go. Yosef?
I think they need to be. I don't think that they are yet. I think that we're getting to a place where people are starting to understand the importance of it.
Right.
But at the same time, while, say, executive leadership understands the importance of it, I don't know that they understand the difference between big and small data.
Right.
So in a sense, if someone's looking to hire some, they understand they need more people who can help them with data. So great. So we'll put them on the data team. We'll put them on the IT team. And after they hire them, realize, wait, all the things I needed, this person now isn't getting or doing for me. I don't have the access that I was looking to get. So I think that we need to get there. Mm-hmm. And it exists. Obviously everyone on this panel is using this. I'm not sure that we're at a place that it's really, getting there yet.
Like the norm, right? Peter, you wanted to say something?
Yeah, I would about this particular industry now, both in financial services currently. I totally agree with you, Joseph. I think that one of the problems you mentioned there, the executives, I think there is a poor data literacy amongst senior execs, whatever the vertical. And I think that they do need to be educated on what is big data, what is small data, and what is an appropriate tool to use in each place. My colleagues at work would know the one thing I would do tomorrow morning if I had a magic wand would be to uninvent the Excel spreadsheet, because in certain circumstances, it's dangerous. But in the circumstances we're talking about here, it's a wholly appropriate tool, and it's knowing where to use the right tools. And I think that requires a high level of data literacy amongst all of us, amongst the execs, to make sure that the right people have the right tools. I do think and I think you probably agree with me, Joseph, we do need a little bit of that data skill discipline into small data. We need to make sure that our methods of data collection are accurate. We know how to keep them accurate. We know how to verify and validate data. And if we can automate that so much, the better, by using an iPad or a sheet of paper. I think it does need to become more important. It does need to grow. But I think we ought to take this opportunity of doing it in the right way.
Right. Yeah, I 100% agree with that, because I think I mentioned access is something that small data can give you. The time that it takes to produce smaller data elements is quicker. And with that obviously comes potential for more error. Where big data works hard to make sure everything is built properly and appropriately, there's plenty of opportunity within these smaller data sets to actually, like you're mentioning, not do it properly. I think that still needs to be a very big focus as well.
But I don't think it's always quick. Yeah, I don't think it's always quicker to get small data. I think that sometimes it can be, and sometimes if you really are trying to get under the covers at a process and a change management process, it can take quite a long time to figure out, you know, what is the small data we really need and what is the best way to collect it. And then most importantly, how do we feed it back? You know, big data is expensive, but sometimes small data is expensive as well because it can be labor intensive. And in my experience, I think sometimes organizations and executives shy away from that because they can just sort of buy some big data and then they can feel like they're checking the box and they're doing data versus really working with small data and about engaging. To me, small data can be much more engaging than big data. And to engage, it takes time and energy. And there's a cost associated with that. I think it's a cost that pays off. You can look at your return on investment because you can really then change processes and usually increase revenue and bring in more business. But there is an upfront cost sometimes with small data that is not anticipated.
Right.
Robin, are you, I'm just curious, but where you work, is there one team that you're getting the big data and the small data from, just one team and they're...
No, it would be much easier if all our data were coming from one place. In our particular study, we're working with 16 counties across New York State and across four states. I have counterparts in other states. So we're working with state, with the New York State Department of Health and other state level agencies and federal data banks for the big data. And then we're working at smaller levels with the county, which is sort of medium sized data. And then we're working at the provider level as we're trying to monitor performance as communities are selecting evidence-based practices and we're monitoring their implementation of those. That's the really small data. So we're getting data from lots of different places. And then our challenge now is figuring out, you know, how to best aggregate it. How to match, you know, matching big and small data, you know, how do they work together when there sometimes are shared identifiers, most of the time there aren't. So how do you look at a trend that's happening on big data and you're studying it at smaller levels and make those connections? So this is a lot of what our research is grappling with to try to figure out how do you implement evidence-based practices, you know, and make them work at the smaller provider level.
Right. Thank you for that. I was hearing earlier, you know, talking about an organization, if you're embarking on a project that's involving data, whether it's big or small, like where do you start? It's important to understand what exactly are you trying to do, right? Mm-hmm. And what exactly is it that you need? And before you can assess, you know, what data you need to access, it's really important to understand where you are on the data maturity spectrum, right? So to Yosef's point, you know, some organizations have many teams working on data. Some have only one team working on data, but understanding where you are in terms of the maturity for the organization is important. So, thank you for that. So I was going to ask, I'll ask the panel, what are some things that big data can do and help us with that small data just can't? That may be an obvious question, but somebody give it a try.
Again, like I'll very briefly, because it's not a healthcare example, but I'll go back to my utilities experience. And I gave that example where healthcare, where small data could indicate to us where things were going wrong, if we could settle it out for noise. Big data gave us the opportunity to predict where things may go wrong. In other words, we can collect huge amounts of data from the water network and predict where we're going to get blockages or where we're going to get leakages or drop in pressure by just the sheer volume of the data. We could do predictive analytics. So that's, to me, that's in that context, that's where it's really useful.
Okay.
Yeah, I agree, Peter. And we're doing a lot of work with predictive modeling. Again, we're focused on the opioid epidemic, but we look at big data from lots of different data sources, and we have a whole modeling team that's looking at seeing where you can predict, opioid overdose, prevalence of opioid use disorder, and then predict possible overdoses, so you can, anticipate where there might be some hot spotting and bring in preventive services and treatment to those areas.
Beautiful, Zoe. It almost feels like predictive analytics could be very useful in your space as well, right? In treatment plans.
Yeah, absolutely. And there's also been a big push. So we know by looking at the data and seeing which programs have been run successfully and where children are, especially as they enter into adolescence, whether or not early intervention has worked, right? So they've followed a lot of that data to say, okay, as long as we get a child before 8 years old, and in particularly before 4 years old, we know that a lot of this intervention, as long as we have, 25 hours a week or, just front load a lot of therapy, that we can get some really long lasting change. And then because of that, we've seen a lot of legislative changes. So we've seen that now ABA has to be covered by insurance. It's mandated in a lot of states and there has to be certain licensure in place. And because of that, we've been able to implement more programming. So it's been really nice. I think that's the big picture. And then you have the little picture and each step of what the way. So a lot of change.
Totally. Well, thank you, everyone. We are at the point of the agenda where I'd like to check in with Daniela because she is on the line and see if there are any questions posed by the attendees. So Daniela, go ahead and unmute yourself.
Yep, I am here. I was experiencing some feedback just now, but thank you everyone for attending today's session. We do have one question in our Q&A box, and it is, can any of the panelists share any stories on how they used small data to either address or uncover insights on social determinants of health or public health?
So we'll open that up and feel free to chime in.
I mean, I can take a stab at that. I mean, we're obviously very interested on the intersection of social determinants of health and the opioid epidemic. We're trying to look at transportation. We're looking at food insecurity, among other things. And so we have some of the big data where we're looking at claims analyses. We're looking at overdoses and overdose deaths in various communities. But then we start looking at smaller level. We start looking at the zip code level. We do a lot of geomapping. We're trying to see, we actually, looking at homelessness. So there are certain areas of communities, areas of towns where you start seeing spikes in overdoses. And it's often places where there are food banks, where there are SROs, hotels that are servicing individuals who are suffering from homelessness. And so then we use that small data to know where we need to bring in our prevention services. One of our interventions is around increasing the use of a drug called Narcan, which reverses the impact of the overdose and saves lives. So we bring a lot of education into those communities as well. I'm not sure if that exactly addresses the question.
Anyone else want to chime in on that one? Okay, thank you. I'm interested. I heard you say, food insecurities and, access to food. I'm actually having a guest in a couple of weeks on the show talk about her farmer's market and how they were addressing the food deserts in her community. So, and how she's used small data to serve that population. So very interesting stuff. Good stuff.
Does the panel consider geomapping small data, or do you consider that more, big data?
Peter, you're laughing.
I mean, I sort of see it as smallish data because it brings it to the person level, so to speak, at least in terms of our type of intervention. But I think one could also make an argument that it falls a little bit under big data as well. So maybe it depends on how you're using it.
It also depends on how you're visualizing it. I think if you're visualizing it as a heat map or as a choreograph, then you tend to work into bigger areas and bigger distributions. think what you're describing there is point distributions that you might get into small data. I saw a study once called the Billion Dollar Block, which is on the cost of post-crime intervention in New York City. And it worked out by the population in blocks. And that, to me, was in that ground between small data and big data, because it was obviously aggregating together residents in blocks, but it wasn't actually just saying, you know, the cost of recidivism in New York is X. It was absolutely fascinating. Yeah, geospatial data is
very nice. Do we feel like visualization in general is big data? I guess it depends on how you're using it, right? Because
the realms of technology around data visualizations now enable you to blend big data with small data. And we've all seen interactive presentations of data where you're seeing big trends in graphs, but you can roll over you can the data points and filter that down. The way that some of the COVID data is being presented. It's like that. It's awesome.
Interesting. Joseph and I have actually been able to create some awesome visualizations in the small data space. So I believe it's a place for in both worlds. So Daniela, are there any other questions in the chat box, in the Q&A?
That's the only question for now.
Okay. Folks may be a little confused because she's coming up as Tanasia Gonzalez, but she's my partner in crime, and that's why it's looking like that. But so we've come to the end of the podcast, and I want to thank Zoe. Did you want to say something?
No, I just wanted to say thank you.
Okay. Now I want to say thank you again to my panelists. You know, I love sitting around. I could talk all day with you about small data and different projects and things we want to do. So Peter Jackson, Dr. Robin Kerner, Joseph Miller, and Zoe Papazoglou, thank you so much for joining me today. And thank you to my attendees for tuning in. To subscribe to the podcast, you can find us on Spotify, iHeartRadio, and TuneIn, and look up Let's Talk Small Data with T, no apostrophe. You can also go to EIMA-INC.com and click on Let's Talk Small Data to learn more about the podcast. And this brings us to the end of our program. I'm also going to put all of that in the chat box for your reference. And I would love to thank everybody once again for joining me tonight. This, like I said earlier, this is the very first episode of the podcast. So excited. It went live. Thanks again for being a part of this journey with me. Have a wonderful evening. And remember, unleash the power of your small data. It's your most strategic asset. Good night.